The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. When I was trying to think of a topic for this Dharma talk, I asked some of the monks, and one of them suggested how training liberates us from suffering. Buddhism talks about there is suffering and there is a cessation of suffering. And it's very important to remember the second part, that there is a cessation of suffering. And I wasn't coming up with anything to say until someone else suggested, looking at it from a different angle, how has training liberated me from suffering? And so that's what I'm actually going to be talking about today. And please don't think that I am totally liberated from suffering. I'm sure those of you who know me know that I'm not. However, I am not suffering in the very deep way that I was when I first came to Shasta Abbey 39 years ago. So there are some people who come to Buddhism because they have had a glimpse of something deeper and are trying to find out more about it, trying to find a way to continue that experience. And some people come to Buddhism because they are suffering to some degree or another. And for me, I came because I was suffering deeply. And the greatest suffering for me was not having anything to believe in, not having anything to have faith in, to trust in, not having any sense of anything deeper than what I was taught as a child. And what I was taught as a child was not worth living for. My childhood was not the greatest, and it was kind of cold and mostly compassionless, although not completely. And my deepest fear was that life was meaningless, and it was like a negative emptiness, kind of a cold, bleak darkness. And that's what I feared of life. So that was my greatest suffering, was feeling just totally lost. And this became really clear to me when I finished college and was trying to figure out what to do next with my life. So this was my time of deepest suffering, was when I was struggling with, does life have any purpose? I'm lost, I'm alone, what do I do? And just coming to Shasta, finding my way to Shasta Abbey about 2.5 years later, just seeing that there was something, that something actually resonated with me, because I'd been searching for a few years. Just seeing that, just sensing it, just seeing the people demonstrating it, it wasn't just a theory, it was being shown to me, alleviated some of that suffering. It gave me hope. And I think that was the deepest suffering, having no hope and no faith. And it gave me hope, and yet, of course, that isn't enough. We have to do the teaching that we've heard to really realize it for ourselves. Now, I realize that this may not be the cause of the deepest suffering for other people. Everybody has their own take on suffering and their own what is the hardest for them. But I think finding something that resonates, that works, that has meaning, that shows us how to live our life and find the cessation of suffering is a start, is a big start. my pages are all scribbled up because I typed them up last night, and then I scribbled a bunch of things on them today. So I came to Shasta Abbey, and first time in 72, and then became a monk in 73. At that time, and not that I don't now, but at that time I had many ways in which I responded to the world which were based on my own kind of mental survival, based on the self, the protection of the self, having a certain image of myself, trying to make the self feel good, or maybe not quite so bad. We have all these habits that all these ways of being that sometimes we're not even aware of, ways we respond to people, ways we think, that are based on a self and helping that self. And for me, some of these ways were very convoluted and unhealthy. And in some part of me, I knew that, but I didn't know another way. And it kind of helped me feel not quite so awful. And I don't even remember what they were now, some of them. But in thinking about it, I don't remember consciously trying to change, but just in the day-to-day practice of meditation and trying to keep the precepts and trying to be mindful, trying to be kinder, at some point I looked and they were gone. I wasn't doing them anymore. So I think as we find a new way of being, we can gradually let go of the old way of being that created suffering for ourselves. And now I still do have some of these things that I am aware of and that I'm working on now. And I'm sure there are many more that I have blind spots to, that I will see in the future. But this is one way in which just the training, the going on, helps us to gradually let go of our old habits that are unhealthy and create suffering. Now you must first believe that you are the source of your own suffering. Because if you don't believe that, you're not going to get anywhere. And I had a hard time believing that when I first came here. As most of us, well, I don't know if most of us, but many of us believe that it's other people's fault, it's the way the world is, it's because of the job I have or the people I'm with or whatever is the source of your suffering. And as long as you continue in that direction, you won't find an end to suffering. But if you just are willing to believe just a little bit that you are the source of your own suffering, then you can do something about it. And eventually you actually see how you create suffering in sometimes just very, very minor ways. I had an interesting experience when I was in college, and as you may have guessed by now, my college days were not happy ones either. They were a struggle, and I know that everybody isn't like this, but we all do have suffering. But it was difficult for me. I didn't make friends easily. I was shy, and I also got depressed a lot and generally felt miserable. Not all the time, but, you know, some of the time. And I have a very bad memory, but it's interesting how certain things you just never forget. And it was just a very simple incident in which I woke up one morning, and I can still picture it, actually, and I didn't feel miserable. I can't remember what I felt, but I knew that I felt okay. There might have even been brightness, and I just honestly can't remember that aspect of it. but it was very pleasant. And then I remember all the thoughts and feelings of being miserable started coming up, and pretty soon I was miserable again. And so this is something that I wanted to talk about how much we believe in our thoughts and feelings and views of the world. And I did very much when I first came here. I believed in all the feelings, maybe not all of them, because I was working on myself, but some of them were so deeply ingrained that I continued to believe in them and act on them and continue my suffering. I forgot where I was going to go from there. So in my notes I have, I'm going to read from Buddhism from Within, which was written by River Master Daizui, who was actually ordained with me in 1973. And this is, I really like this book. And I'm going to read parts of this chapter called Things Are Not What They Seem. The Four Noble Truths, the Law of Change, and the Eightfold Path are the foundations of Buddhism. When people put these principles into practice, their view of the world begins to change. This change is gradual and subtle, yet also far-reaching. The practice of Buddhism leads people to some surprising conclusions and rather unique perspective on things. A book like this can only describe such a viewpoint in words. Those who actually live by the Buddhist way experience it directly and personally. So the subheading is about things. Now this book was written as about Buddhism in general. So he didn't write about Soto Zen Buddhism, which is what we practice here, Serene Reflection Meditation. But he wanted this book to be accessible to anyone who didn't know anything about Buddhism and just give a general view from the inside, from a Buddhist monk, of what Buddhism was about. So this is about things. The law of change, for example, has some startling implication when it is actually taken as the basis of a person's way of seeing the world. We usually regard material objects, things, as being separate and independent from one another and from us. However, if everything is always changing, what is a thing really? In the first chapter, I used this book as an example and mentioned how it was never quite the same from moment to moment. If it is different now than it was a minute ago, which one is the real book? You could say that they both are, but notice that even though we may say that they are the same thing, they actually aren't the same. So what does it really mean to say that they are the same thing? And suppose you get fed up with my ramblings and decide to burn this book in the fireplace. When exactly does it stop being a book? And what about those chemicals that you sniffed up when you smelled the book a few chapters ago? Are they still the book, or are they now you? Interesting questions. In one sense, these questions aren't really about books and fireplaces and you. They're about how we view the world and what we tell ourselves about it. We tell ourselves that there are things out there, but that is actually a handy little fiction. There really is no such thing as this book. There is only an ever-changing flow of space, time, being, which we sometimes find useful to divide up in our minds and call one of the parts that we have mentally created a book. After a while, a Buddhist actually starts to see the universe this way. Now, don't get me wrong. It is not that Buddhists become unable to perceive books as separate sort of things. In fact, they'd have a very hard time getting through life if they couldn't make use of the usual sorts of little fictions. It is very useful, for example, to call a large metallic perception a bus and to tell myself that it is coming down the road that I am walking across, better get out of the way. Children spend the first few years of their lives learning how to create exactly these sorts of handy fictions. And so they pull themselves away from relating to the world as simply a swirl of change and flow. People who can't learn to do that, and there are some, have a real tough time in this world. Buddhism is a practical religion. It doesn't teach that to live by truth requires us to walk in front of buses. Instead, it leads people gradually into seeing our little fictions for what they are and simultaneously to recognizing a whole other level of reality. One can continue to make use of the handy fiction that things exist, while at the same time not entirely believing that the world is populated with things that act on each other. This enables a person to live normally and still have room in their mind to experience the reality of the undivided, ever-changing flow of space, time, being. Then I'm going to skip to the next section about the universe. So if words and things are simply handy fictions, does the flow of space, time, being have any properties that are true and reliable? Buddhism holds that it does. Actually, the first one has already been hinted at. If things don't really exist as such, then a true property of the universe is that it is empty of all things, and all things are fundamentally empty. Now, when Buddhists talk about emptiness in this way, they don't mean that there is nothing there, that it's all just a big fat zero. Some philosophers have believed in that sort of ultimate nothingness. They're usually a pretty gloomy bunch in consequence. But that's not the kind of emptiness Buddhists are talking about. Instead of seeing the world as a place where there's nothing, they see it as a place where there's no thing. When an individual can set aside the useful fictions of thoughts, words, and things, he or she can actually see, understand, be this emptiness of the universe. From that perspective, one can simultaneously see the unreality of the bust, stand in awe of the wonder of the flow of space-time being, and still cross roads without getting squished. I say the wonder of the flow of the universe because there is yet another consequence of the law of change. The first is that everything is always changing. The second is that it's empty, and the third is hard to describe. The ancient scriptures mention that a property of the flow is that it is unborn, unbecome, unmade, and unconditioned. Because it is unborn, it is also undying and eternal. Because it is unbecome and unmade, it is void of all that can be known and grasped, and therefore pure and tranquil. Because it is unconditioned by other causes, it is complete as it is, and it is a true refuge. In other words, this universe of ours is not only changing and empty, but also at the same time, it is utterly chock full and awesome. Another way to put this is that space-time being itself is ultimate truth, and to be at one with it is to find the peace we are all searching for. So I'm going to skip again. Even a moment of getting close to these conditions allows for a taste, a deep drink of enlightenment, which is enough to change a person's life. And that is a good thing, because going deeply and thoroughly into all of Buddhist training requires making massive changes in one's entire way of being. It is a lifetime's work. The fact that lesser changes and temporary moments of success along the way have deeply beneficial and lasting consequences is what keeps most Buddhists going. The next section is, what about you and me? So I'm going to skip again to just one part of this. And this actual section is the reason why I'm reading from this book. Having the idea that each of us exists as a comfortably constant sort of a self, separate from each other and the world, and able to act upon the things around us, is a very handy notion. It is not a bad approximation of how things are, and it greatly simplifies dealing with the basics of life, survival, reproduction, not getting hit by buses, things like that. That may be why we human beings do it. It has evolutionary survival value. Certainly the unfortunate people who fail to develop a sense of self, like those who fail to develop a sense of things, have a much harder time of life than those of us who acquire a nice solid sense of being me. However, the fact that having a sense of self is a handy approximation to truth does not make it true in an ultimate sense. And since Buddhism is interested in helping people get as close to truth as they possibly can, approximations aren't good enough. For this purpose, the useful notion of a self gets in the way of looking clearly at one's experience of existence and of seeing it for exactly what it is, always changing, always flowing, never the same from one instant to another. In other words, Buddhism holds that you and I are simply ideas and names which we superimpose on the more fundamental experience of flow. We are convenient fictions, just like things are. We have no more reality than this book has. Sorry about that. All of this becomes more and more real as a person puts the Eightfold Path into practice. This business about the self not being real is not just a mental exercise. It has important consequences for how people live their lives. This is because the belief in a self tends to form the nucleus around which we form all sorts of other beliefs and attachment. Which is exactly the point. To see through the fiction of a self is to understand the basis for attachments. That makes them a whole lot easier to give up, and that makes for a much less unhappy life. But this isn't all. To the extent that we loosen up our grip on a self, we see that you and I are actually part of something larger. We're both part of the same wonderful flow of space-time being that everything is. This sense of oneness acts to deepen an individual's empathy for other people and for all creatures. A person understands and experiences in a new way just how much it hurts inside when he or she harms someone else. Letting go of the notion of a separate self did not create this interconnectedness. It was always there. But it does enable one to be more acutely aware of it. And becoming aware of just how interconnected we really are, a whole new level of insight opens up as to the causes of our core unhappiness. In addition to being aware of the unhappiness that arises from holding on to desires, a person has a new appreciation of just how much unhappiness comes from hurting other beings. The two are connected, of course, because most of us don't really hurt others simply for the fun of it. We hurt them either because we think it is necessary in order to get something, or because we are acting under the influence of the intoxicants of anger or delusion. The insight into just how powerfully we are all interconnected is the reason why the Eightfold Path speaks so much about refraining from harming others. It is also why some tradition of Buddhist teaching pays as much attention to living an ethical life as they do to giving up attachments. There is yet another consequence to allowing the notion of a self to drop away, joy. It is a joy that is somehow related to a sense of having come home, of being where one has always belonged, of waking up from a bad dream of ultimate aloneness. So that was the part I actually wanted to read about, waking up from the bad dream of ultimate aloneness. That, I think sometimes is a deep fear for a lot of us, and we seek for relationships with others, some deep relationship with another being that will help us to feel connected. However, through this practice, we find that we already are connected, and we find within ourselves what we seek from outside of ourselves. And still we can have good spiritual friends, but we find what we need within ourselves. One thing that was coming up during the ceremony for me, when we were singing the scripture of Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, the Bodhisattva who represents the great, selfless, all-embracing compassion of the universe, that which is within all of us. Something in me was kind of letting go into that compassion. In my training over the years, I have experienced at some points a glimpse of that selfless compassion. And just a glimpse of it is enough for me to feel okay about all of life. Everything is okay when I sense that, because I think my deepest fear in childhood was that selfless compassion did not exist. However, because that was such an ingrained feeling in me and belief in me all of my life until I came to Buddhism, it comes up for me. Doubt comes up. The doubt in the compassion, the doubt in Buddha nature. It arises, and it can make me intensely miserable. And I remember sitting during a retreat, I remember sitting right over there, facing a wall, and it was towards the end of the retreat, and suddenly all this doubt arose. And it just went round and around and around in my head, and I sat with it, and it kept on going. And when I went outside after the meditation period, something in me was kind of laughing, saying, "Do you really believe in that?" And it was like I let go, because something deep within was speaking to me. And yet, what I was thinking of in preparing this talk and at the ceremony was, why do I believe in that doubt when it arises? I've had experiences of compassion as well. Why do I believe in that doubt? It's just like all the things that we believe in. I think the benefit of just continuing to persevere in training and to keep doing the best we can, even if we make lots and lots of mistakes and don't think we're doing very well, is that we can gradually let go of those ingrained beliefs and habits. And when the doubt arises, it's just a thought. It's just a feeling. When a feeling of negativity arises, when we feel like we're the worst human being on earth or the worst trainee on earth, or what's the point of my training? I never get anywhere, which used to come up all the time. Gradually you know better. You know better, and you know that going down certain roads just continue your suffering. And that's where making mistakes isn't such a big problem, because making mistakes helps us to see where we create suffering. And going down this kind of spiral into misery and suffering, you gradually see leads nowhere. And you don't really want to go there anymore. And I still have all those things come up. Feeling like I'm worthless, feeling like I'm hopeless, doubt arising, everything is dark. And but why believe that? Why not believe in the compassion I saw? Why not believe in Avalokiteshvara? Why not believe in my experiences, my little glimpses of the truth that, as Rev. Master Daizwi said, keeps us going? I mean, why keep on going all these years if you really do doubt it all? So in my training now, I'm really trying to not go those places. And in not going there, it's kind of like you're stepping off into the unknown. Because what used to happen to me in my early years was, you have some experience and you have faith, and then the doubt comes up and then you doubt. Now I forgot what I was going to say. Okay. Um, honestly, is gone. So I'm going to have to accept that. That could bring me to the next point. Well, one of the things that actually helps us in our training is, again, we all have habitual ways of acting and habitual ways of thinking and our own little fictions of how we see the world and ourselves. And because of this, we act in certain ways. And we respond to people. Somebody may say something and they don't even mean anything, and yet it stirs up something in us. Or somebody does say something that hurts us, and that stirs things up. But I found sometimes I get stirred up by nothing anybody said, by just a situation. And we have the choice that we can just be with that really uncomfortable feeling, whatever it is, and be with it till it goes, because it does go. And this really helps us with trusting that we can do this practice, and that there is that purity, that emptiness, that that peace within ourselves, and that we do find it by letting go of all this stuff as it arises. A few years ago, I did a study group in town with some of the local lay congregation on the Platform Sutra, which is the teachings of the sixth Chinese ancestor, Hui Neng. And one of the things that has really stuck with me from his teachings was just let thought after thought go. Thought after thought after thought. No thoughts are important. It's like, this thought I can let go of, but that thought's important. Or this feeling I can let go of, but that feeling's really true. This is something really ingrained that I believe. But just thought, after feeling, none of them are important. It doesn't mean that we don't feel the suffering that either the feeling brings up, or in not believing in them, we actually go deeper into ourselves. We may get in touch with more of our, I hope this isn't just rambling on, but we can get more in touch with more of our deeper levels of pain and grief by not reacting. This is the benefit of writing everything down. You go back to it. You don't lose things halfway through. But it's just the importance of letting go. I mean, this doesn't come easy, but it's just the importance of not treating any thought as important, or any feeling as important. We can sit with each one of them, let them be, and let them go. When I first came here, it was very difficult for me to look at my suffering. I wasn't even necessarily aware of the deeper aspects of my suffering. And what I have found is, through the years of perseverance and training, that gradually I can look at things that I would have found impossible to look at when I first came here. It's like a gradual process of faith growing, trust growing, and just knowing that you have to take the next step, that you can't stay where you are. You have to be willing to just look. You have to be willing to be still, to let go, to trust in what you don't know, to trust in the unknown. It's really a gradual process. That's why perseverance is so helpful. And looking back and seeing how you've made some progress. When I first came here, I felt like I didn't have any faith. And yet, I kept going. I kept staying here. And when I looked back 5 years later, I saw that something had changed, and I did have faith now. So it's really good to just keep on going. In one of the invocations that we sang last week at the festival of Great Master Bodhidharma, who is the Indian monk who brought Buddhism from India to China, is one of the verses says, acceptance of suffering, sitting unmoved, the seeking of nothing, enlightenment proved. And that kind of says it all in a nutshell, although it is not very easy to do. So this brings me to training to just be oneself. Training does not make us superhuman or perfect or someone other than ourselves. It actually makes us, it helps us to just accept ourselves for who we are. And that's actually a real blessing because we can spend much of our life wanting to be something other than who we are. I remember, this is kind of embarrassing, to admit, but that at my father's funeral, when I was 17 years old, I remember sitting there feeling jealous of my sister, who really got along easily with people, and people really liked her, and I was very shy. And being jealous during my father's funeral, that seems a little silly, but these things arise. For a long time, I wanted to be something other than I was. And I was jealous of other people who were this way or that way or having religious experiences or were kinder or were this or that. And one of the monks told me that if you aren't content with who you are, there will always be someone better than you in some way. And there'll always be someone that you'll be jealous of. So so the training is actually learning to let go of wanting to be different, wanting to be other than who we are, wanting to be perfect, wanting to be superhuman. It makes us more human. It makes us more who we are. And I found this to be a very gradual thing because we have images of ourselves that we're trying to uphold in the world. We have ways we want to look like. We care about what people think. And as we go on in training, we realize that this is a source of great suffering and that we might as well just accept who we are. And actually, we can learn to love ourselves, not just accept it, but love ourselves. And it's not wrong to love ourselves. I think this comes about by doing the training, by letting go, by trying to keep the precepts, by trying to be mindful, by as we see more about ourselves that we can change, trying to do that, by being kind to ourselves, not judging ourselves so harshly when we make mistakes, or not judging ourselves so harshly just for who we are. I think by doing that, we started having glimpses of something deeper. And I think it's the awareness of something deeper, and that actually that something deeper accepts us completely for who we are. I had one experience of in meditation of becoming aware of my anger, which those of you who are new aren't aware of, but I have a lot of anger inside myself. And I was aware of that deep anger, and then there was just this embrace of it, that it's okay. It's okay to have this anger. It's not okay to act on it, although I sometimes do because this training is difficult. And if you have a lot of anger, it's hard to just let it go suddenly. But I know that at one time at least, something deep within me accepted me for who I was. And so that helps us to start to accept ourselves. We don't have to be perfect to know the eternal. We just have to do the best we can and keep on going. God, I have this whole other page full of stuff. This is not just an acceptance of who we are, but what we have to work with. Some of us may feel that we have a heavier load of karma, more difficulties in our life, and I think that's true. Some people have a heavier load, some people have a lighter load. But when you think that you have the heaviest of all, then I think you're wrong. Because I used to think that, and I found people who have much heavier loads than I do. And I am very grateful that I was able to find Buddhism and to find compassionate people to train with. But we all have things within us that we find difficult and wish we didn't have. And that's another thing that you have to gradually learn to accept, that this is what you have to work with. And to allow yourself to shine the light of Buddhism on those aspects of yourself that you find so difficult. So within Buddhist training, there is nothing about ourselves that we need to hide from. We can eventually look at everything and know that it's all empty, that it's all just a fiction. Although it feels real and is painful, it's not who we truly are. And we may have to spend the rest of our lives working on this and feeling these things, but we start to know that it's not everything, that there's something much more. I know that what I truly long for is to be one with my true nature, to go home, to be at peace, to awaken from that ultimate aloneness. And yet I keep getting pulled into wanting people to like me, wanting to have good spiritual friends, all these things that I've had all my life try to pull me in all directions. And I'm trying now to make more of an effort to just accept that this is who I am and accept that this is what I truly long for. Although friendships are nice, what I truly long for is to know my Buddha nature and to go home. I was looking in Bhikkhu Bodhi's book called The Noble Eightfold Path to see if I could find anything that he said on liberation. And I did find something that I wanted to read. This is at the very end of his book on the Noble Eightfold Path. This completes our survey of the Noble Eightfold Path, the way to deliverance from suffering taught by the Buddha. The higher reaches of the path may seem remote from us in our present position. The demands of practice may appear difficult to fulfill. But even if the heights of realization are now distant, all that we need to reach them lies just beneath our feet. The eight factors of the path are always accessible to us. They are mental components which can be established in the mind simply through determination and effort. We have to begin by straightening out our views and clarifying our intentions. Then we have to purify our conduct, our speech, action, and livelihood. Taking these measures as our foundation, we have to apply ourselves with energy and mindfulness to the cultivation of concentration and insight. The rest is a matter of gradual practice and gradual progress, without expecting quick results. For some, progress may be rapid. For others, it may be slow. But the rate at which progress occurs should not cause elation or discouragement. Liberation is the inevitable fruit of the path and is bound to blossom forth when it is steady and when there is steady and persistent practice. However, sometimes we fall off and it isn't persistent all the time, but we can just pick ourselves up whenever that is and come back. The only requirements for reaching the final goal are two. I love this. To start and to continue. If these requirements are met, there is no doubt the goal will be attained. This is the Dhamma, the undeviating law. So thank you all very much.